Welcome to today's program titled New 2019 Oregon Employment Laws. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. For those who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen. Then type and send your question that way. At the end of today's event, a link to an online evaluation will be displayed on your screen. Please take a few minutes to complete it. We do appreciate your feedback. I would now like to introduce our host for today's call, Christy. You may begin.
Hi, everyone. Good morning and good afternoon for those of you on the East Coast. This is Christy Totten, and I'm here with my colleague, Leah Lively. We are both partners at Davis Wright Tremaine in the Portland office, and we are both litigators as well as advice and counsel lawyers that work with many of you on your employment issues. Leah and I have both been tracking new bills for a while now on behalf of clients and industry groups and maybe for our own personal interest. And you never know what's going to come out next. So we're going to just get started here. We have a unbelievably large list of attendees. I think there's more than 200 of you from some of the nation's largest companies down to some small, well-loved local businesses. And we're happy to have you all. And this presentation, I think, should be relevant to everyone because these new laws are really for all employers in Oregon, unless we tell you otherwise. So again, please send questions you have as we're talking. We may be able to answer those in real time to clarify. Otherwise, we'll try to hold those for the end and answer what we have time to answer. So we'll get started here. So what is going on in Salem? Those attendees who are in Oregon have probably seen the headlines, and maybe those of you not in Oregon have also seen the headlines. I think they've been on national media quite a bit. So June 30 is the deadline for our state legislature to adjourn. They need to end by then. However, we've had a contentious last week or two in the Capitol. The Democrats have a supermajority in both houses, as well as the governorship, and was it a week ago maybe? The Republicans walked out and have apparently left the state, and the governor's called the state troopers to sign them, and it's been kind of a wild show here, but the end result of all that is that all legislation is paused right now until the Republicans come back so that they can have a quorum. If they don't, there's a question about whether the governor will call a special session in July to try to get business done. And there's a question, I think, about whether the Republican senators would come back for that or not. So everything's sort of up in the air right now on that, but we're going to talk about what we do know. What we're going to talk about today are a whole smattering of bills. So we had about 60 to 70 different bills proposed this year that impacted employers. I'm going to talk first about two of the really big ones, and then Leah's going to talk in the second half of the presentation about a whole list of other things that you need to know for your business. So this is the first of the really big bills that I mentioned. It's called the Oregon Workplace Fairness Act. And this was sort of pitched as a Me Too law. It got headlines regarding its impact on victims or claimed victims of sexual harassment and sexual assault. But you'll see as we talk about this that this law really impacts most discrimination claims in the state in a variety of ways. So effective date is 91st day after the legislature adjourns. So that should be on or about the last day of September. There is a slight delay on a few of the requirements. We'll talk about the new written policy that employers are required to have, and we'll talk about the impact on your employment and severance and settlement agreements, and those provisions don't go into effect until October of 2020. This law applies to every employer that has one or more Oregon employees. So what are the key impacts? First, every single employer is going to need a new written discrimination policy. There is not a single policy that exists that is compliant. Second, there are new statutes of limitations, and again, these are really broad, so we'll talk about that. And then third, all settlement and severance agreements are going to require, at least all forms are going to require a change and some thought about whether changes need to be made. So we'll start with a written policy. This is probably one of the more straightforward parts. No particular order, but number one, written policy. So every employer is going to need this new written policy, and it has to contain the procedures and practices that are used to reduce and prevent discrimination. And then the statute, this is Senate Bill 726, if you want to look up the text. But then the statute goes on to say that at a minimum, your policy has to include these things. The first two, hopefully you all have in your policies, at least in some form. You're supposed to provide a process for the employee to report prohibited conduct, which is discrimination and conduct that's unlawful under this new act. And you're supposed to designate a person who will be receiving reports of discrimination, and also an alternate. So these two are actually things that we already advise and we see most clients already have in their policies. No big change there. Number three is a really big change. So as we'll talk about in a minute, there is now a 5-year statute of limitations for defined unlawful conduct. And that's going to include most discrimination claims in Oregon. The statute of limitations right now is 1 year, so 5 years is a big deal. And the written policy needs to now affirmatively state what that statute of limitations is. So you'll be advising employees how long their statute of limitation is. Leah's shaking her head as a litigator. again, this policy doesn't need to be implemented until October of 2020. So although we do recommend getting ready ahead of time, we don't recommend putting it in place now and telling people that they have this long limitations period that they don't have. Number four, your policy needs to tell employees that the company will not require or coerce them to enter into non-disclosure or non-disparagement agreements. Number five, your policy needs to say that despite number four, employees may request those provisions as long as the agreement gives them 7 days to revoke. And then number six, your policy needs to advise the company and the employees that they are supposed to document unlawful conduct. So you may have some form of number six already in your policy, but we'll just want to make sure that all policies are compliant. And the Bureau of Labor and Industries, which is our state agency, BOLI, they will be coming out with a form for some guidance as we craft policies, and that's due out by September. So another change for the written policy is when the policy must be distributed. There's three times. First, at the time of hire. So that should be in the handbook going forward once this law is in effect, and you'll need to make sure that that handbook is handed out at the time of hire. If it's not, then you'll want to make sure that there's a standalone policy in your hire packet. We would typically see that out in the handbook, however. Second, the policy needs to be provided at the time of the complaint. And what the statute actually says is at the time that the employee discloses information regarding prohibited discrimination or harassment. So when an employee comes to your designated person and discloses information regarding discrimination or harassment, then this policy has to be affirmatively handed to them. Again, this is starting in 2020. This is going to raise all kinds of issues, I think, in litigation, and it's going to be interesting. I mean, the first step is easy, is to train your designated person that they have to hand out this policy and to be prepared to counsel them if they fail to do so. But some of the other wrinkles include things like, you know, to me, if you're handing out that policy, you're sort of admitting that you think the complaint is about discrimination or harassment. And as we all know, sometimes you can't tell, right? The person says, I've been bullied, and there's always a question about Are they? Are they not? And so that'll require some strategic thought to think about how that policy is handed out and whether it's a good thing, whether it creates more liability, how that's going to work. So this will be sort of one of those. A lot of the presentation today, I think we'll have to wait and see and think carefully about how the law is going to work in practice. And then the third time that you need to hand the policy out is that it just needs to be available in the workplace. So this will probably be posted in the place that you post your notices. Okay, the second big bucket under this new law is the statute of limitations. Again, I already mentioned this, that currently the statute of limitations for almost all claims in Oregon is 1 year. That's moving to 5 years. So for certain claims. So as of this fall, you will have a 5-year statute of limitation for the following discrimination claims. Number one, under 659A.030. So those are your race, religion, gender, sexual orientation, that whole list of things that's under that statute. Number two, you'll have a 5-year statute of limitations for discrimination against uniformed service members. And then number three, you'll have a 5-year statute of limitation for disability claims, discrimination. Some of the other claims will still have 1 year. So your whistleblower claims, your Oregon Family Leave Act claims, it's sort of been separated here. So it's not everything. And then starting in 2020, this 5-year statute of limitations will apply to violations of this new bill. So presumably that means the stuff we're talking about today with your employment agreements. We'll talk about that in a minute. So there's a lot of tips we could add here, but I think the main one is that as we move into a 5-year statute of limitation, it's going to have a major impact on document retention and hold policies, what the company wants to preserve, how we're going to get evidence in litigation, how we're going to save evidence in litigation. So that'll be a moving process. All right, here is the last portion of this new bill. And it's kind of the messiest one, I think, and maybe not that well drafted, because you can read it and read it again and sort of take different things away from it. I think the bottom line to this is that this requires some huge, there are pitfalls and traps here for employers, but at the end of the day, a lot of these can be worked around, I think. So the first rule is, you can, starting in October 2020, employers can no longer include a non-disparagement or non-disclosure or no rehire provision in any settlement, severance, or separation agreement with a person who's claiming to be a victim of discrimination or sexual assault. Again, this is the broad range of discrimination, unless two things happen. One, the employee requests the agreement, and two, the agreement gives 7 days to revoke after signature. There's an exception that if the agreement is with the accused person rather than the accuser, then you can still go ahead and have non-disparagement or no rehire clauses, and you don't need to get the request for that provision or the 7 days to revoke. I think that you should still get that request and revocation, in part because I think not doing so under the law is an admission that that person committed the conduct, committed unlawful discrimination, which is almost never in the company's interest to admit. So I would still get the request and revocation with that person too. There are damages. This is an unlawful employment practice starting next year to include these provisions without going through the steps. And so there are punitive emotional distress and other damages. So there are several questions under the meaning of this law if you look at it. One is, if you can't include these provisions of someone who claims discrimination, what does that mean to claim conduct constituting discrimination? Does that mean a formal complaint? Does that mean they've raised it at some point and you know they've raised it, but that's not the point of the severance? That will be, I'm sure, heavily litigated. Another big question is, what does it mean to request these provisions? Is it enough in an arm's-length transaction? So in settlement of litigation where we have opposing counsel, this seems like it may result in the defendant saying, we're not going to settle the case unless you request these provisions. Is that going to be seen as coercion? As you can imagine, that'll be a little trickier in severance situations to get a request. I do think that at the end of the day, the prohibition on the non-disclosure and confidentiality agreements are really only as to stopping someone from talking about the facts of discrimination. So it doesn't impact that you can say, you know, confidential as to the amount of the severance. And so a lot of times we already don't include that kind of provision. So again, the impact of this may be a little narrower than it first sounds, but you'll have to be careful to go through your agreements. The law also allows companies to void their prior severance obligations with certain managerial folks who have been terminated for violating the discrimination law based on a good faith investigation. This, again, I keep saying things will be litigated, but I think certainly if you try to start voiding prior severance contracts, you're going to see a fight from your executive about whether or not you can void that based on the fact that they were terminated for discriminatory conduct. But this is another portion of the law. And then finally, besides, we just talked about severance and separation and settlement agreements. The law also says that as for your current employees and your prospective employees, you can't include any of these non-disparagement, non-disclosure, or any provision that has this purpose or effect of stopping them from discussing discrimination. And that's pretty broad language. It talks about this being an unlawful practice if the conduct occurs off-premises or on-premises. It goes on for a while, but the again, the actual application may be fairly rare. What this is saying is you can't force a current employee to not talk about the facts of discrimination. And the situations in which that arise are not necessarily that common, but if you see that fact pattern come up, just make sure you are aware of Oregon's new law. So to wrap this up, you're going to need a new written policy for 2020. You're going to need to train your employees, your managers, about distributing it. You're going to need to think about your how you're going to handle this five-year statute of limitations. You're going to need to revise all your agreements to at least include a flag to remember to check. Do you need this employee request, and do you need this seven-day revocation? And down here, I just included two links. One is to an advisory that our firm did, and one is to the language in the actual bill if you want to read that. Okay. And I'm just seeing if we have any. We have a few questions, and one of the questions I can answer fairly quickly, so I'll take that one. One is whether the statute of limitations change means that documents have to be kept for 5 years. And not necessarily that you have to, but you may want to, right? And so we would already recommend, in general, a retention policy longer that long, but you'll need to look at each situation and weigh the cost of the business and the risk of litigation and what you need to keep. It's going to be different for different businesses. Okay, so now I'm just going to cover the second big bill before I turn it over to Leah. This one has not passed yet, so I just want to be clear about that. It's been pushing through the legislature all year. It's going to pass in some form at some point, either this year or next year, but this is not law yet. But it's so big that I just want to make sure that we talked about it. So it passed the House on June 20. The Republicans then walked out, so it stalled. The Republicans walked out because of a controversial cap-and-trade climate change bill. This bill, I understand the Republicans actually do want to pass in some form, and so do the Democrats. So if the legislature reconvenes, I think this is one of those bills that would probably get pushed through, but we just don't know yet. Because it's such a broad sweeping program to set up this insurance fund in Oregon, the effective dates are set out quite a ways. So there is built-in time to plan, then employee premiums get collected, and then eventually it goes into effect. So it's kind of a long view. This applies to employers, again, with one or more Oregon employees. It creates a new protected leave of absence. So that's about your fifth one to deal with here in Oregon. It creates new reinstatement rights after leave, starting if you've been employed only 91 days. It provides paid leave, which is partial up to full, depending on income. And there are several new duties that employers would need to comply with. So I'll just take a few minutes to flip through this one so you understand sort of the big picture. And for anyone who's interested in this and hasn't gotten involved, I would just urge you to really get involved with legislators and talk about the specific impacts on your business, because we've seen this bill really evolve this session, and it's improved, and there have been a lot of changes made, I think, in answer to some different sort of logistical, practical ways that it impacts businesses. So those of you who have operations in other states know that there are several states that already have similar paid family medical leave bills and insurance programs. Oregon's is a little different than those. It is an insurance program that's run through the state. It would be funded by premiums paid out of payroll deductions. So the employee would pay 40%, the employer would pay 60% in the current bill. It provides at least 12 weeks of leave with that partial or full wage replacement, and we'll talk about kind of how those weeks work. There can be circumstances where people get more than 12 weeks. Again, it creates a new protected leave, and we'll talk about that. Employers have responsibilities to collect premiums, pay premiums, keep record keeping, and do other issues. And there are some other sort of quirky sides, and one of them is that employers will be able to volunteer to have their own voluntary equivalent plan. So that would really only be for larger employers who want to pursue that route. And some of you may have already pursued that route in Washington, for example. So to be eligible, it's a fairly low bar. The employee only has to have earned $1,000 in the base year prior to applying for leave. They need to be contributing their percentage, and that's changed over time, what percentage it's going to be. We don't quite know the final yet. And then they need to submit a claim through the insurance program. All employers are covered by this new law. By this bill. Again, this is not law yet. All employers are covered. There are a few places where there's some relief for smaller businesses with fewer than 25 employees, but they are still covered by most of the functions. We'll talk about that. And then for those of you with unionized workforces, it does not require you to reopen a bargaining agreement, but it does require that those entered into after the bill becomes effective, that those would have that those need to comply. And we have a question about union employees and how it would be tracked, because union employees switch employers frequently, and so do a lot of other segments of the industry as well. And this is really a state-run insurance program. So employers would be collecting premiums out of all the payroll, submitting them quarterly, which we'll talk about, but then an insurance program either run by the state or run by a third party that the state contracts with, that's the entity that's going to take the claims, figure them out, pay the money back out. And so even someone who's switching employers frequently because they work for a temp agency or their union or whatever the reason is, they will also have, this will all be tracked through the centralized function. So anyone doing business here knows we have a lot of laws already and that deal with leave. If someone has OFLA or FEMA leave and they're eligible for that, this law says that they run concurrently. If someone has Oregon sick leave or any kind of voluntary paid time off that the company offers, the law says that the employer may permit concurrent use up to 100% of wages. So for example, if this insurance program based on my income says that I get 80% of my wages replaced, then this bill would allow me to also supplement with my PTO to go up to 100% of wages. And then the last part is if the employee is receiving workers' comp or unemployment, then they do not also get the paid family medical leave. Okay, here's the meat of it. In a benefit year, employees get up to 12 weeks paid, again, it could be partial, for family, medical, or safe leave. This is kind of akin to Oregon family leave reasons and current state law. So there's more there, but just for purposes today, this is up to 12 weeks paid, kind of any combination of those issues. However, and this is one of the places I think the law is a little confusing, but let's just walk through it. 12 weeks. However, if the person has OFLA, Oregon Family Leave, and they're running concurrently, then the employee can take up to 16 weeks. It's not all paid. Some portion of it, 4 weeks or more, can be unpaid OFLA. And then third, the law says that if you're already doing those two things above or separate from those two, there's also 2 weeks paid for pregnancy and childbirth-related issues. So in sum, the employee can take up to 18 weeks total. 16 of those can be paid. The increments can be as small as a workday. And these alerts and this panic button, those are mine. That's my panic as I read the law. Here are the two big things that that I think are going to cause huge wrinkles in some cases. One is that the family member definition does not match OFLA. So it's different. It's broader. So it covers siblings, for example. It covers people who have close associations that are like a family relationship. It's broader. And so what that means is that let's just take a quick hypothetical. I start working for a new company. It's day 100. My brother has a serious health condition. I apply and I take 12 weeks paid under this program. Okay, now I keep working. Now I've worked there half a year and my daughter has an issue, a serious health condition. Now I get up to 12 weeks of OFLA because I haven't exhausted that yet because I was never eligible for OFLA with the brother. So this employee gets 12 weeks paid, 12 weeks unpaid. One of the many weird quirks of this law, if you think about it, is take the exact same employee in the opposite situation. The daughter gets sick first and then the brother. Exactly the same thing. Well, in that situation, the employee would get 12 weeks paid under this new bill for the sick daughter. But then when the brother gets sick at month 6, doesn't qualify for OFLA because siblings aren't covered. No additional leave. There's a lot of hypotheticals you can come up with where it just shows you that this bill would require employers to think through how to apply this leave. It's not sort of easy and basic. And again, one of the problems I think is that it doesn't just track OFLA and just create that into being basically a paid program. The other alert I have here is that the timing doesn't line up. So this is a protected leave which can't be interfered with, retaliated against, any of that from day one of employment. And then starting at day 91, there's also reinstatement rights. So you get your job back, no matter what. So again, that's not going to overlap with current OFLA law, FMLA law, that kind of thing. So again, just an alert that there are some major changes here. Again, payroll deductions are at a 40-60 ratio in the current bill. That could change. It's changed several times already. The current maximum is a deduction up to 1% of wages and up to $132,900 maximum. There's a complicated sliding scale I won't get into, but essentially, if someone's making minimum wage, they're going to get 100% wage replacement. If you're a higher wage earner, it goes down. It's a reduced rate. There are caps on sort of the maximum benefits, maximum contributions. There are quarterly requirements for employers to comply with to remit to the state. And small employers, that's defined as those with fewer than 25 employees, they are exempt from making contributions into the plan, so they don't have to pay the contributions. But if they choose to, then there are some grants available. And again, those small employers do still have to comply with these other rules. For example, a small employer would still be liable if they refuse to give someone a leave. That would be unlawful. just a quick rundown of a few of the employer obligations. Job reinstatement, the rule again is going to be that once someone is at their 91st day of employment, they get their same position back when they return from this leave. There is a slight exception currently for small employers, but it's fairly narrow, right? If there's a business necessity, you can find a similar position. There are prohibitions on retaliation, posting written notices, requirements for how payroll records are going to track hours and leave, rules, extensive long rules, this bill is 38 pages currently, on deductions and collections and how the employer is going to do that. Every version of the bill I've seen has had rules about successors and how currently outstanding premiums are accelerated and owed quickly if a successor takes over the business. And so that's just kind of something to have in mind if your company is contemplating a deal in the future or reorganizing, that there may be some expedited requirements. And there's all kinds of liability for the company to not pay on time. So, and then again, there's an option for voluntary equivalent plans and a way that employees can apply for that. We have a good question about how short-term disability payments play into this, and that is really a big question. I mean, our colleagues in Washington have been working through a similar but different bill, which has been going into effect. They've had 7 rounds of rulemaking, we hear that companies are doing all kinds of different things or thinking about all kinds of different things with the short-term disability programs that they currently offer. This bill isn't crystal clear on how legally it would interact with short-term disability. Okay, so your next steps, again, because we have a little bit of a lag time, both because the legislature is currently not meeting and because it's taking them a while to get this into place, I would again encourage everybody who hasn't but has an interest to get involved, read the bill, talk about practical ways that it might affect your business so that those small tweaks can be considered. Then you're going to have to plan the impact on your business. If you want more information, here's a link to the actual language of the bill, and I'm more than happy to talk about it anytime. Right now, we're going to move on to Leah, who is going to tell you everything else, or mostly everything else, that's been happening in Salem. All right. Thanks, Christy. Before we get going, I just wanted to answer a quick question that was posted on our question session, and that was whether the OWFA has already passed. Because we know we just talked about the law that has not passed, but the OWFA has already passed. We're not waiting for anybody to come back from hiding out anywhere or anything like that. So that one has passed. All right, so let's go on to some of the other lesser but still important bills that have already passed. So the next several bills that I go through are going to be ones that are already going to be law, if not already law. And you'll see on each of these slides we have an effective date, and some of them are italicized because those effective dates have already come in the last 6 weeks or so. So the first law is House Bill 2341, and this is accommodations for pregnancy-related conditions. As most of you probably know, under current law, case law, pregnancy in and of itself is not a disability. Although complications from pregnancy may be, pregnancy itself is not. This law comes a little bit closer to making pregnancy and any limitations related to pregnancy a disability. This law is effective January 1st, 2020. And the summary of this law is, where an employer knows of limitations related to pregnancy, childbirth, or related conditions, including lactation, it is an unlawful employment practice to, 1, refuse a reasonable accommodation, 2, deny employment opportunities based on a lack of accommodation, 3, take an adverse action, discriminate, or retaliate because of an accommodation request, 4, require an unnecessary accommodation, in other words, something that you think the employee should have or needs, but they don't, Or five, require OFLA or any other leave to be taken if the employee can reasonably accommodate. So let's say you have a situation where a new mother needs to not come in to work for a certain period of time. She needs to come in late, and her job isn't dependent upon being there at a certain period in time, and she asks for a schedule change. You're going to have to look at whether that is a reasonable accommodation, and can't simply say, well, you need to take OFLA leave to handle that, the pregnancy-related issue that you're having. I think the interesting thing about this law and sort of what remains to be seen based on how it's drafted is the fact that this law is going into Oregon Chapter 659. And Chapter 659 deals with not only disability discrimination, which is what this seems to fit into, but also deals with gender discrimination. So the phrase, if you will, a limitation related to pregnancy, it's unclear what that means. Does that mean a physical limitation related to pregnancy? Does that mean some sort of emotional or mental limitation related to pregnancy? Does that mean scheduling change? Does that need a need for to be able to sleep more? You know, what does that mean? I think is going to be litigated. And I think the bottom line takeaway for most employers is that now when you have an employee who, or an applicant, remember this applies to applicants as well, who you know or are made aware of is pregnant, one, don't assume you know what they need, right? You don't want to get in trouble by requiring an unnecessary accommodation or assuming that somebody needs something that they don't. But two, you essentially need to treat that person as if you would somebody who's requested an accommodation under the ADA, and you'll need to go through that interactive process with them and look at making the accommodation instead of saying you need to take leave. The other part of this bill is that the employer must post signs and provide written notice, and because it dovetails into disability discrimination, there are carve-outs if the reasonable accommodation would create undue hardship. But remember, that's a really difficult thing to prove. So that's the first bill we're going to go through that's already passed. Again, effective date January 1st, 2020. The next one is relatively straightforward. This is House Bill 2589, and this went into effect on May 6th, 2019. So it just went into effect. And this law clarifies that for the purposes of state disability discrimination and accommodation law, sexual orientation is not a physical or mental impairment, and an employee does not have a disability solely by reason of the individual's sexual orientation. Pretty straightforward there, and I don't think there needs to be much explanation other than if you have an employee, their sexual orientation doesn't mean that they're disabled solely because of that. If there is an actual disability that that person has, then you'd want to accommodate that, but their sexual orientation alone is not a disability. Okay, the next law is one that has some changes to Oregon law, but really won't have too much impact to those of you who've already been complying with federal law. This is House Bill 2593, and it deals with the ability to express breast milk in the workplace. The effective date is the 91st day following adjournment of the session, which again should be sometime right around the end of September, first week of October. And the purpose of these changes in this House bill was to conform Oregon law to federal law, and it got close, but didn't quite get there. So we're just going to go over some of the old rules and then what the new rules of this law, which will go into effect this fall, will mean. Under Oregon's old statute, statutory language, the need to or the ability, the right to express breast milk was strictly tied to timing. So in other words, you'd get so many breaks per work segment that you could express breast milk. The new rule is that the employee gets reasonable rest periods each time they're needed. So if you have one person who needs them every 2 hours, they could request them every 2 hours. If you have somebody who needs them every 4 or 5 hours, 4 or 5 hours. If there's an employee who says they need them more often than that, then you need to work with that employee to make sure that they can get the proper periods. The old rule was that the employee shall provide notice to the employer of the need to express breast milk in the workplace. And the new rule is when possible, the employee shall provide notice, which one would think that the employee is going to know that they need to do this, but to the extent they don't, you can't take it, hold it against an employee and say, well, you should have told me about this a week ago. You need to do your best to work with that employee and accommodate them. All right, a couple of more changes. The old law applied to employers with 25 or more employees and contained an undue hardship exception. The new law applies to all employees, but the undue hardship exception excuses rest periods for employers with 10 or fewer employees. So now even the smallest employer has to allow rest breaks for expression of breast milk, and the only employers that can use the undue hardship excuse are going to be employers with 10 or fewer employees. So that's a big change right there that our smaller employers will need to look at, but doesn't really have much of an effect on our larger employers. The next one isn't really any change at all. The old Oregon law and the new Oregon law say that the ability to express breast milk is for women with children of 18 months or younger. The only reason we point this out is because federal law is 12 months or younger, so you do want to make sure you're complying. If you have Oregon employees, you are complying with Oregon law, which allows for a child up to the age of 18 months. Okay, this next law is one that is just one more tick in the rung of making non-competes harder for employers in Oregon. This is House Bill 2992, and its effective date is January 1st, 2020. And what it does is it mandates that to be enforceable, an employer must, within 30 days after the date of termination of employment, so it's a post-employment obligation, provide the employee with a signed written copy of the terms of the non-compete agreement. In other words, a signed copy of the non-compete agreement. So our tip for employers here is if you don't already have an exit checklist that HR, whoever your exit manager is, make sure you create one. We understand that probably you're not going to have that many employees who sign non-competes because Oregon has already restricted them fairly narrowly to who they can apply to. But for those employees that you do have non-competes, you do want to make sure that you are getting those non-competes to a place where they can be enforced. So we highly recommend having a checklist, and that checklist should include a checkbox of a calendar reminder to send out the non-compete. And when you are sending the non-compete within 30 days, I would send it in a couple of different ways. I would send it by regular old trackable snail mail with a return receipt or some sort of proof of delivery. And you could also send it by email, but we often have people saying, I didn't get the email, I didn't open the email. So, and the statute wants you to send an actual copy of it. And then follow up with a letter to ensure receipt. Dear Mr. Jones, we sent you a copy of your non-compete on January 2nd. If you didn't receive it, please contact HR manager at this number right away. And the other advice is make sure you're sending the non-compete sooner than within 30 days. So in other words, if you have an employee who terminates and you want to enforce the non-compete, our recommendation is that you send it out within the first week so that you can calendar your follow-up within 2 weeks. And if there's any problems, you will still have time to get it to that employee within 30 days. Okay, the next law has a lot of words here on the page, but it's actually fairly straightforward in what it means. This is House Bill 3120, and essentially what House Bill 3120 does is says that an employee cannot be disqualified from unemployment benefits if he or she voluntarily leaves work, doesn't take suitable employment, if he or she or a member of their immediate family is the victim of conduct that more likely than not constitutes the crime of intimidation, or if that individual believes that his or her immediate family member could become the victim of such conduct or is seeking to protect him or herself or immediate family from such conduct that the individual reasonably believes is likely to occur if they have continued employment or take that suitable, acceptable work. And the crime of intimidation, both in the first and second degree, is defined on your next two slides. But in a nutshell, what the crime of intimidation is a hate crime. So if somebody is threatening another person with physical injury because of the person's race, color, religion, sexual orientation, disability, or national origin, the person's family member, or subjects that person to offensive physical conduct because of those characteristics, that is going to be a hate crime for which a person cannot be disqualified from unemployment benefits. All right, there are a couple of other lesser bills, if you will, that have passed. Again, these ones have already passed. The first one is Senate Bill 370, and Senate Bill 370 went into effect on June 6, 2019, and it says, this one is a little bit interesting because it says, unless prohibited by federal law, employers within 3 business days of receiving a notice of inspection from a federal agency compelling the employer to provide access to records and documentation used by the employer to verify the identity and employment eligibility of the employee, they must notify the employees. And the law does have very specific notice requirements. So you can imagine this situation is one where the DOL or ICE comes in and says, we want your records of what you looked at to make sure these employees were documented legal employees. This law requires that employers give the employee notice of that request within 3 business days of receiving the notice. So that's quite a tight turnaround time. So whoever is in charge of receiving those notices needs to make sure they're being passed on to the correct players immediately. Senate Bill 164, it goes into effect January 1st, 2020, and this bill requires employers to comply with requirements of the Oregon Retirement Savings Plan, which is simply a board. So this is going to have very narrow application that most employers won't have to deal with unless they have somebody who's on that board. Senate Bill 1049 went into effect June 11th, 2019, and it redirects a portion of employee contributions of PERS members to a pension stability account. For those of you who are not familiar with Oregon's public employee retirement system, it's been in litigation since as long as I've been a lawyer, at least 20-some years, and faces numerous challenges, and this is a bill designed to try to stabilize the PERS fund. A couple more. Senate Bill 823 requires healthcare employers to conduct comprehensive security and safety evaluations that may cause violence committed against employees on the premises of a healthcare employer. So if you're a healthcare employer, make sure you are doing this as of January 1st, 2020, but don't wait to get that plan in place. House Bill 2660, which was signed June 17th, but we don't have an effective date yet, removes the prohibition on payment of unemployment insurance benefits to non-professional employees of an educational institute who are seeking unemployment essentially between scholastic terms. Senate Bill 494 was signed June 13th and sets wage requirements for employers authorized to employ individuals with sub-minimum wages. There's a very narrow band of employers who are allowed to do that. And Senate Bill 519, which goes into effect January 1st, 2020, increases the minimum wage exemption for purposes of wage garnishment. There are a couple of pending bills that have not yet passed, but we'd encourage you to keep a lookout on, because where these were stopped in the process with the Oregon issues related to the House and or related to the legislature lead us to believe that had our legislature been functioning, they would have been passed and will probably pass once the legislature is back and functioning again. The first is House Bill 3009, and it provides that it's not an unfair labor practice for a labor organization to charge certain employees reasonable fees and costs for representation that's unrelated to negotiation of a CBA. So if you're a union employer, you want to be aware of this. Senate Bill 478 prohibits campaign and public money from being used to make payments in connection with a non-disclosure agreement related to workplace harassment. So no more using public monies to pay elected officials for harassment claims is basically what this is a response to. And Senate Bill 123, which is actually employer-friendly, provides that it's not a violation of our pay equity requirements to pay different levels of compensation to individuals who are performing modified work in certain situations, such as they have, you know, a temporary work restriction, they're on modified duty, something like that. And it also provides that evidence of increasing an employee's pay due to pay equity analysis cannot be considered an admission of liability in a civil case. So sort of a subsequent remedial measure rule, again, positive for employers. So let's hope that one gets passed. And we're not going to go into these with too much detail because we have a lot of questions, but for those of you who have employees in Washington or California, there's a couple of laws that you want to be aware of that have recently passed and are going into effect soon. Washington has passed the same law that says, like Oregon, that says you can't ask an applicant for prior salary information. It goes into quite a bit of detail about what you can and can't ask for and when you might be able to ask that information. So I would encourage you, if you're a Washington employer, to make sure you're taking a look at that and that the job applications that you're receiving are updated so that you're not seeking inappropriate information on those job applications. Washington also passed a rule regarding non-competes, which sets pretty high restrictions on the income level that an employee must have in order to be eligible for a non-compete. If it's a W-2 employee, they can't earn less than $100,000. And if it's an independent contractor, it's less than $250,000. And California has a couple of new laws, too, that are going into effect on January 1st of 2020. One is similar to what we have in Oregon, which is settlement agreements cannot include non-disclosure of sexual harassment, discrimination, retaliation, and that a complainant may request a limitation on identity. Like Christy said earlier, the amount can be confidential. So this is not getting at the amount of the money. It's getting at discussion of the facts that this person was sexually harassed or a complainant of sexual harassment or discrimination. And the last one is if you're a California employer, you already know that there are harassment training requirements, which have been in place for decades. This updates that and says California employers with at least 5 employees, including temporary and seasonal workers, must provide the 2-hour sexual harassment prevention training for supervisors and for other employees every 2 years. So it's just a modification of what's already existing. So those are the new laws in Oregon, the ones to look out for, and Washington, California.
So hopefully everyone took good notes and their heads aren't spinning too much. I have one, this is Christy, I have one correction on a slide that I just want to flag, and we'll send out this presentation again afterwards. When I was talking about the Oregon paid family medical leave and the percentage in the current bill that the employee and the employer would be contributing, the current bill says the employer contributes 40%. The employee contributes 60%. So there's one slide where that's flipped, and again, we're going to fix that and send that back out. But just to be clear, that's what the current bill says. unknown whether that's how an eventual law would land or not. We also had a question that made me just want to note that, of course, today is not legal advice. This is good general information for what's happening. But if you do have specific questions about your workplace, please call us or call your regular employment counsel to talk about that. So we have about 5 minutes, so we'll try to plow through a few of these questions. One question, I'll kind of go back through in order, was about the Oregon Workplace Fairness Act, which is the first bill I talked about with the new statute of limitations and impact on severance agreements and that kind of thing. And the question was, what if we have an anonymous hotline? The law says that we have to have a specific contact person at the company, and if we have an anonymous hotline, does that work? Who's going to give out? This is a kind of a combination of a few questions. Who's going to give out that policy? Is it okay to just name the title of the person and not identify the individual? Those kind of specific questions aren't in the current bill, and we do expect BOLI to issue regulations. So it's possible that that will be further clarified in the regulations. But what the law says is that when designating a person, the company has to, quote, identify the individual. So does that mean I have to say Christy Totten can take the complaint, or does that mean it can say the director of human resources can take the complaint? Not clear in the law. I think it would probably come down to whether the person knows who to contact and whether that person is acting compliantly by giving out the policy, taking the reports, and that kind of thing. We also had a question about what happens if the discrimination is first disclosed at the exit interview. And I think that kind of depends on whether if you have not yet entered into a severance agreement and you go into the exit interview and someone claims discrimination and you're still going to be entering into an agreement after that, then I think you need to comply with the new law. The question will be, what if you already entered into the severance agreement and then someone later raises discrimination? That will need to be sorted out. I don't think there's a clear answer yet. Jumping to the paid family leave, there's a question about how this affects the 36-week allotment that employees can take under the Oregon Family Leave Act. And it's a little confusing, but really those laws are separate, right? There's a bucket of entitlement under Oregon Family Leave Act, just like there's a bucket of entitlement under FMLA and under Oregon sick leave and possibly as a disability accommodation, and now under this fifth law. So they're really separate buckets. There is a little overlap because of that provision I mentioned that talked about how 12 weeks could turn into 16 if you had concurrent OFLA. It's the question of what's going to happen with the rest of it, I think, still needs to be sorted out in that bill, and that's one of the things that I think legislatures will need to tackle. And then I just want to real quick touch on one more question about paid family medical leave, which is, does this apply to temporary employees? And under the current bill, I think yes, if the person is eligible based on the wages that they've earned from some employer in the base year, then they are going to be able to submit a claim to the state and take their leave. Now, if they're a temp worker and they haven't worked for your company for 90 days, you would still have to allow them to take the leave, not retaliate against them, do all the employer obligations, with the exception that they wouldn't have this, under the current language, they wouldn't have this reinstatement right unless they'd worked for you for at least 90 days. Now, if they work for you for 90 days, you have to put them back in their job. There's also a provision in there about replacement workers who come in to fill for people who are on these paid medical leaves, that those people don't have reinstatement rights. So, again, there's a lot in there, but those are kind of some of the high points. And I think we just have 1 minute left. Leah, was there anything that you wanted to make sure to hit before we hang up?
Yeah, we had several questions on the posting requirements on some of the new laws in Oregon, and we didn't have time to go through all of the posting requirements specifically on the expression of breast milk. Those are in the statutes. And, you know, if you want to follow up with us, we can get those for you. Or if you look up the bill, those are in there. And then on the non-competes, there were a couple questions about what about the other provisions of the Oregon non-compete. Do those still apply? Yes. Remember, in Oregon, the person has to be non-exempt or has to be exempt. They have to earn a certain amount of money. You have to provide the non-compete 2 weeks prior to the person's first day of employment. And the answer to the question was you have to give them an actual copy of the non-compete or just notification that they signed it, I would give them the actual copy of it. There were several questions regarding to limitations, the known limitations on somebody who's pregnancy limitations. The answer to those questions is we don't know yet. The statute unfortunately doesn't say whether we can request medical verification like you could for a disability, and so we're going to have to wait for BOLI to issue regulations or to tie that into the disability discrimination statute, which would allow there to be some request for a limitation of what those limitations are from a medical provider. But my sense is that they're not all going to need to be from a medical provider, but again, the statute doesn't say, so it's going to be a little bit of wait and see. All right, well, I think that's all we have time for, so feel free to follow up with me or Christy, and we hope that this was helpful to you as employers, and we thank you for your time and attending today.
A link to an online evaluation is now displayed on your screen. Please take a few minutes to complete it. We do appreciate your feedback. This concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending and have a good day.